I wanted a bell for my bicycle. So I went to Coin Cycles in Kinnegad on a Saturday in January 15 years ago. And afterwards I paid a visit to a friend, an old woman who lives just outside the town. This was 15 years ago, so I was still cycling a bicycle. I look at bicycles now and they look to me like I never cycled them at all, you know. I still have one. It's an awful lot of grime and dust on it in the green shed at the bottom of the garden. Anyway, to come back to Kinnegad all those years ago, this lovely dear friend of mine, an old lady, she gave me tea and brown bread with homemade marmalade. And we talked about Kinnegad in the old days, when everyone travelled by bicycle. And the tailor sat in his shop window, and the tannery cured cattle hides and exported them to swanky leather shops in England. My mother died in childbirth, the woman declared. She had 8 children, and she was only 38, and I was only 15. After the funeral, the priest came to the house and said he had all the arrangements made to take us away to an institution in Kells. And my little brother was sitting on Daddy's lap, and my sister was at his feet on the floor, and all of us were around him, holding on to his shirt. The priest told Daddy that he would never be able to manage all those children on his own. That bit of land you have wouldn't feed snipes, the priest said, so we'll take the children off your hands. That must have been a dreadful moment, I conjectured. Yes, she said it was, but thank God my father spoke up. He said, if it's all right with you, your reverence, I'll keep me children as long as I can, and when I can't, I'll let you know. And the clergyman never came to see us ever again, or never inquired if we died of hunger or not. On the way home, I noticed a barrel-top wagon in a field with a couple of piebald gypsy cobs grazing nearby and a family huddled around an open fire with a boiling kettle. Scrap iron was piled at a distance, and the horses had thick and hairy legs. 2 teenage sons sat by the fire, quiet and gentle, and their father sat beside them, and he said they were having a better life on the road than in any housing estate. We chatted for a while about wagon designs, the ornamental scrolls and gold leaf that mark English gypsy wagons, and the horse and other figurative work that marks Irish traveller wagons. I was born on a farm in Kildare, the man said. I brought the barrel-top wagon in from Wales. I asked him, did they think the world was falling apart? But they just laughed. That's the kind of thing people in houses worry about, the woman said. When I got home, 2 men with guns and dogs were in the stable yard, lacing their boots before they marched up the fields in search of rabbits or wild pheasants. I didn't try to engage them in conversation because I know nothing about the sport of shooting. The only time I ever tried to shoot anything was in Fermanagh with a friend who strapped me to a gun one day, threw a bucket in the air and told me to fire. I fired before he could get out from under the flying bucket, and the shot went so close to his ears that it almost ruined our friendship. There's a dread in the air before a gun goes off. Not a twig breaks beneath the shooter's feet. The woodland is still. The reeds in the river make no sound. And the beating heart in the woods that the shooter wants to wound thumps against its own ribcage. Fear oozes out into the air. The erotic scent of a death to come. The hunted animal, sensing what is about to happen, is filled with a dreadful arousal. On Saturday's 6 o'clock news that week, long time ago, the politicians were in a state of arousal, like agitated bees whose hive had been disturbed, and they were talking about the future as if it was a dreadful abyss. But that's how the cookie crumbles. In 2011, during the economic crash, I suppose, we were on the threshold of a new era, and the dross of history was suddenly looking like it might be swept away in a moment. And politicians like rabbits were caught in the tractor's headlamps. They were overcome with dread, and the only thing the poor creatures could do was cling to each other and sing, "We are where we are." "We are where we are" was the great song of 2011. In the chaos of the economic crash, everybody would say, "Well, we are where we are." When I turned off the television, I heard a loud bang, which I guessed was a shot somewhere up the fields behind me. The gunmen had bagged my lovely friend, the pheasant, who used to loiter around the laurel hedge all winter, looking for shelter. Do you know, I was, in January of that year, I was beginning to get ill, but I didn't know what was ahead of me. And I'd lost money like everybody else in the economic crash. Any bit of money I had as savings was in Aircom shares, if you don't mind. And they all went into zero. But I didn't know that there was... I didn't know what was ahead of me, I suppose, is what I'm saying. And I suppose I'm saying, too, that there's an extraordinarily randomness about our lives. I was here this morning, for example, and I was looking back to find this particular memory, actually, to find this column. And do you know the way you go through old files on your computer? You search... And there's files come up that you had forgotten about. But they're like the tracks of the animal from 10 years or 15 years ago. Especially if you're like me, like you're a writer. I make my living on the computer. This is my, it's my loom. I love to talk about the computer like it's the loom. And I'm a weaver. And it just so happens that I weave stories rather than blankets or lovely tweed materials. I just weave, and the wool for me is the love of other people. It's like I can only hear stories when I feel a sense of love with other people. You know, if I feel that I'm listening to somebody with a kind of a resentment that I don't trust them, or that I'm looking at them like they're a stranger and they do things differently to me, it never works. I go away from them and I can't remember what they said because there was this voice going on in my head, which was kind of a judgmental voice about them. Now, I don't mean a judgmental voice that I'd want to sort of hate them or kill them or something, but just as a stranger, you know, there's a tendency that I would have, I think everybody has it, and that is to kind of size people up. you know, to evaluate people. And you're doing it all the time as you're listening to somebody or as you're watching them. You're measuring them up. And sometimes society praises that. They'll tell you, oh, he's a very intelligent man. He knows that he can size people up very well. And that's seen as a good thing. But in some ways, I'm not so sure, do you know, because what it does for me is that it puts this voice in my head and I'm there listening to somebody. I can have a conversation with them. I hear what they're saying. But then when I walk away, there's nothing left. It's like I forgot it because this voice was going on in my head. And what I need to do always is if I have a disposition of love, it's like technically it's better as a storyteller. Somebody said to me one time, one old storyteller talking to me, a writer talking to me, and he said, you know, the only story ever worth writing is the love story. And he said, in another occasion, you can't write unless you're in love. I used to think for a while that he meant, you know, romantically in love with the beloved. But what he was getting at was that if I'm sitting in front of a stranger, like the old woman in Kinnegad, if my head is full of judgments about her, even if they're positive judgments, even if I'm thinking to myself, oh, now she's a very lovely woman and she's a very wise woman and she could have great stories, even that, it's interfering with the listening process. The only way the listening process works as a storyteller is when you're fully present to this person and you're saying your full emotional commitment is love. And then there's no voice. This is like when you look out the window and you see a beautiful bird and for a split second you forget everything else to do with your ego and you're just enraptured with the bird. It's love. It's like when you've gone outside yourself. And you might think that's a mystical experience and maybe it is, but the way to get there for me is there's two ways I do it. And recently I've been blending them together. One way is when I recite a prayer that I mentioned previously. It's a Buddhist, it's what they call a guru yoga. It's a yoga, it's a mental yoga. So we think of yoga as a physical, stretching the limbs. And then we think of our mind as a brain where all the ideas are. But in actual fact, there's a way of thinking about the body that as you stretch the body, you're living not just in your brain, your consciousness is in your heart. You know, the Orthodox people talk about the nous. You know, the nous is that when you bring your consciousness into your heart and your heart is kind of, you're aware from the heart. You're in a kind of an acting, loving disposition to the environment around you. And that's a great exercise because it's the only way that you can actually say a prayer like, in Christian terms, I believe in God. If you say, I believe in God, the Father Almighty, you say that prayer, well, you're only setting out a load of ideas. There were actually ideas which were put together at the Council of Nicaea and then the Council of Chalcedon and maybe a few other places. But these were big symposiums, big councils that the early church had in the 2nd, 3rd, 4th century to agree on, you know, a definition of our shared faith as Christians. It was inevitable that they would do it, but it ended up that you had these kind of collections of ideas. And the creed is one of them. You know, I believe in God, the Father Almighty, creator of heaven and earth and in all things visible and invisible and blah, de blah, de blah. It's a full collection, a kind of a necklace of the crucial points that Christians believe. The resurrection of the dead and the life of the world to come, all that stuff. But if you say them in your head, so you're just like rattling a bag of stones, a tin can full of stones rattling. That's all you're doing. The only way to do it is when you, funny enough, when you use skills which are very well developed in Buddhism, skills that allow you to bring the mind into the heart. And now when you say, I believe in God, you know, even just that one sentence, you could spend the next 10 years or you could spend the next lifetime with that one sentence. I believe in God. You could say that sentence every morning, but not with your brain, but with your heart. And if you're doing it from the heart out, like an emotional sense of carrying the sense of I believe in God, what's the object of it? Only the sunlight, the dawn, the landscape, the birds, the frost on the grass, the coldness, the rain, the warmth of the fire, all the little things on the table in front of you, like your porridge and your apple and your boiled egg. You know, the relationship of your body to the world around you is one of love, is one of harmony, is one of just being with your body and looking at your boiled egg and looking at the boiled egg and you say, I believe in God, because the boiled egg is God and the porridge is God. You know, everything around you is God, and you can be dealing with that world around you, like trying to measure it up and assess it, and as if your brain was a computer, you know, getting the size of the egg and the value of the egg. But sometimes you need to bring that consciousness down into your heart and say, I believe in God. And then you realize that these things are blessings. And if I'm with an old woman in Kinnegad, I need to be able to say that, you know, I need to be able to say, I believe in God. And then she manifests to me as God. This is the veil. This is the only thing in front of me. I believe in God. My body now, from my heart up and down, all through my body, I believe in God. What is God? The reality that is beyond all language. We know the inefficiency of language. We know the inadequacy of language. We know it. And yet we have a sense that language struggles to get us somewhere. You know, it gets us to the door of something and it doesn't bring us into the house. We can say, I love you to our partner or to our child, but it's just not enough in language. It's a tin can full of stones rattling, making noise. It's only when from the heart you're kind of aware of yourself and you're looking at your child and you're thinking, I love you. No, you're not thinking that you're feeling it. You're feeling this in your body. This is yoga. I made this discovery for myself through Tibetan Buddhist practices. And I realized when I started 25, nearly 30 years ago doing guru yoga, which is to visualize the guru, the teacher. For me, in that practice, it's this guy called Tsongkhapa. He's an ancient scholar who formulated the whole kind of web of ideas in Buddhism and all the skills of it, and he put it into a kind of an order, and he became the founder of the Gelug the Gelugpa, the Gelugpa school of Tibetan Buddhism, and that's the lineage from whence comes all the Dalai Lamas, all the Panchen Lamas, including my own teacher, the Panchen Utra Lama. And so this wonderful Lama, in lineage from the beginning of that tradition, taught me this prayer. He's in Jampa Ling, West Cavan. You can connect with that website. It's a very precious jewel in Ireland. There are so many wonderful different places now, so many wonderful different ways to access faith. I mean, you access faith only in your own heart, but places that allow you skills and methods that will trigger the faith in you to come to the surface. And it'll allow it to come to the surface in ways that are not old-fashioned, in ways that don't block you. You know, in the old institutional system, people were getting more and more blocked, alienated, because of the kind of fossilization of ideas and the subsequent manifestation of things like, I have to say it, misogyny, blah-de-blah, all sorts of, you know, they used to have a thing in Catholicism, a principle that said, extra ecclesiam nulla salus est. Outside the church, there's no salvation. Like, what it meant was that, let's say, if you compared salvation to the sun shining on you, you would say, thinking about how the sun benefits everything universally, you'd say that without the sun, there is no growth. But that's not to exclude people. And a principle like that, in the traditional institutional history of the church, it became exclusive. So outside the church, there's no salvation. It didn't mean the joy of the sun shining in your heart. It meant the crowd on the other side of the street will never get to heaven because they're not our crowd. And that's basically the kind of problems you have when ideas in a, like stones in a tin can rattling around in people's heads, and they argue, your stones are different than my stones. And then eventually they get real stones and throw them at each other. And that's all coming from a way that we think only in the brain. What I discovered, I remember when I was being ordained. I mean, I remember when I was being ordained a deacon, and I didn't like the idea of celibacy. It was like throwing myself over a cliff. It was like Abraham taking a hatchet to the sun. You know, the most precious thing that I thought was important to me at that age in my life, and I was about 26 years of age, was my sexuality, my future, my potential as a father and as a lover. I thought, I'm going to step in here saying I'm committed to this pathway for the rest of my life. And I thought, this is scary, you know, because I didn't agree with it as a set of ideas. But I agreed with it in my heart. I knew that embodying the mystery of priesthood, if I did it in my heart, then the ideas wouldn't matter that much. They would fall away, or they would change, or I would change and learn and grow. Maybe be a wonderful celibate monk or something. But no, my destiny was to find the beloved as a human being, as a partner. So I was trusting in God at a time when intellectually I couldn't make sense of why I would trust in God. It didn't seem to me rationally a good idea to throw myself off a cliff, and yet that's what I was doing. That's a freedom that, you know, St. Paul talks about, the freedom of the children of God. And I often think that's the core of it, you know. You actually liberate yourself from all the ideologies, all the tyranny, all the things that you don't agree with and all the things that you do agree with. If you step into space, if you step into your body, if you step into a sense of being the, what they used to call, you know, the temple, that said that your body is the temple of the Spirit of God, is embodied in every molecule, every atom, every bone, every fibre, every muscle. You're in there. God is in there. The unnameable being that transcends all language. And you can step in there as Christian. As I said, the place that I found, I learned to do it was in Buddhist practice. And it was with Guru Yoga. And you can look up Guru Yoga and practice it yourself. It's not a big deal. It's just a kind of devotional prayer, as you say, to your mentor deity. And while for me it might be Tsongkhapa, it could be for you Jesus or Muhammad or Abraham or Elijah or the Virgin Mary, the Queen of Heaven. It could be whoever is your... It could be a Saint Francis or Saint Teresa, it could be whoever. Whoever is there as your mentor deity, and they manifest in front of you, and then you go through the prayer of the Guru Yoga, which is a kind of a, like yoga stretches your body, but this, it's like stretching the emotional or spiritual muscles of your heart, opening you in a way that you can feel it the minute you start doing it. And you know, as I speak these words, I just hear you agreeing with me, because nobody lives without this experience. Nobody lives without love. It's weird. We all know this. It's so kind of accessible, this experience of embodied love, that you are there as a vessel of energy, of love. Okay, what does that love mean then? Because I don't want to be kind of airy-fairy about this and talking about energy, but in the very first line of that prayer in Buddhist practice, and I talked about it before, I go for refuge until I am enlightened to the Buddha, the Dharma and the Sangha, through the positive potential that I create by practicing generosity and the other far reaching attitudes. May I attain Buddhahood in order to benefit all sentient beings. It's a bit of a gymnastic thing intellectually, but if you break it down and if you repeat it three times and then repeat it three times the next day, gradually the kind of fabric of it, the architecture of it as an idea, will begin to come clear. And as you embody it, you will find that it stretches your compassion and your wisdom. Imagine those two things, compassion and wisdom, as great muscles. And simply by repeating the prayer, it's like swimming up and down in the swimming pool, strengthening your arms. This strengthens the kind of capacity, the muscular capacity of your wisdom. That's the only way you can talk about, when you talk about love in the heart, you're talking about wisdom and compassion as you embody them, not as you think about them, not as you understand them, not even self-reflecting on, oh, look at me, how good I am to be so compassionate. No, that's all like Pharisee stuff. That's all our painted sepulchres, as the great Sufi teacher Yarusha said, painted sepulchres. Do you know what I mean? Oh, look at me, I'm not how wonderful that. There's an awful lot of us go on like that. I go on like that, you go, we go on like that. We think I'm wonderful because I'm doing good. And it's actually the self-consciousness, the actual consciousness of doing good poisons the whole activity. Where you're wanting to get to is this space of being with somebody, or being with the cat, or being with the bird, or being with the frosted grass, and just being there in a way that your whole heart is wishing that in every moment I will be generous. In every moment I will be giving in every moment. I will be helping the other. I'll be wishing well to that bird on the feeder. I will be blessing him with wishes of millions and millions of wishes that he would be well, and that that bird would have so many reincarnations to the point that he too will reach complete enlightenment. So I'm sitting there thinking, like, in my heart I'm breathing love, I'm breathing this sense of compassion that every being will find happiness in this life, and ultimately the happiness of complete enlightenment. And you can do loads of other practices, like visualize your family around you when you're doing guru yoga. You know, your mother, your father, your children, your whoever, cousins, aunties, uncles. Visualize them all, and then visualize your friends, and visualize people you don't like, people you really can't stand. Some of them might be people like in your life that you can't stand, and others of them might be, you know, people on the television that you always want to be given off at, that annoy you, irritate you. Think of them around you, and think of yourself embodied, embodiment of love, wishing them well. Not with your tongue in cheek, but wishing them well. Really, really trying to penetrate the truth that they too are struggling in their lives. They're suffering just as much as you or me. They have anxiety, depression. They went through birth and old age and death. They're going to go the same journey. They're same vulnerable little creatures as we are, and they're all trying to find enlightenment. And now you're wishing. And you're growing. The more you do it, as I say, it's a guru yoga practice. The more you do it, then it improves your compassion. It's just like any other exercise. And that's why it's called yoga, guru yoga. Your guru might be Jesus, might be Buddha, might be Allah, Muhammad, whoever. But you practice that the energy from this person, the relationship you have with your deity, will feed you in a way that the light is coming into you and filling you, and then the light from you, from your heart, is going outwards. Now, I'm going to come back to where I began this little reflection, because this is a really, for me, terribly important point as a writer, as a storyteller. I realized at some stage that I could only write if I listened, and I could only listen if I developed some level of that compassion that I'm really listening to the other person with my heart. And that means, in terms of Western culture, or the old writer who said it to me one time, you can only write when you're in love. And of course he meant when you're in love with the person that you're writing about. Now, there's the real key. That's the real moment why I would call this whole workshop, this whole reflection this week, a workshop. That's the key. It's being in love with this person in this moment. It's practicing, whether it be a kind of Christian thing or a Buddhist thing, or any other religion you're coming from as your language of connection with the divinity. But that which makes everything sacred, that which makes the entire cosmos a kind of a veil that is endlessly revealing the mystery that is beyond language, beyond all our experience, and yet holding our experience together. And that's the moment when you're sitting with somebody, and now you're a writer. Listen to their story and write it down. Doesn't mean copy their story. You could be creating a fictional character. You could be constructing a play or a short story. You could be using just this snippet of visually the old lady I'm speaking about. She was beautiful and elegant. She had silver hair. She sat beside a range in a country kitchen. And she had a lovely sense of composure. And she was talking about, as I say, like all those children. She gave that description herself. A beautiful word picture. How her father was there and them as children. Clutching his shirt. 8 of them. Holding on to him. As the clergyman said, "We'll be taking the children away now." And the clergyman might have felt, well, we might just have a demonising attitude to the old clergyman. And there's a real danger that we constantly do love and compassion for a kind of a sense of who's deserving of love and compassion. And then we always hold on to a certain group of people that we despise as the enemy, as the people who don't have love and compassion. And sometimes we see old clerics in the past as not having love and compassion. It's okay to hate them. Or in wars, sometimes we take one side and then the other side we see as the devil, we see as evil. They're bad. But we're compassionate because we're compassionate to one side. And it's very, very tricky because that can pull you down. There's something indiscriminate about compassion. Compassion is not an evaluation of the other people who deserve it. It's a capacity of your own body, your own emotional intelligence, your nous, your heart. Love is another form of knowing, as some old Pope said. But that is the way that I write. And I discovered it only through Buddhist practice. And I came back to Christian practice, fair enough, about 7 years ago. But I certainly feel that those were the things that helped me be a writer. And when you get that kind of openness to the world around you, there's a way that what impinges on you is kind of random. And sometimes I'm able to write then that reflects the randomness. In other words, I'm not looking for psychological connections of causality between one thing and another. It's something that narrows a writer very much sometimes when they're writing a story and it follows a kind of a mechanical logic. Because it's not the way the world works. So in the reflection that I shared with you, I mean, I talked about the fact that it started musing about a bicycle and going to get it fixed in a shop in Kinnegad. And then I happened to be close to this woman. I knew where she lived at the other end of the town, so I went down to her. And for no reason at all, she told me the story. It was incidental. She hadn't planned to tell me that day, and I hadn't planned to hear it. I went into her kitchen and I sat down and there was silence. And it's another thing that, you know, sometimes you can be afraid of silence in a conversation, and so you impose a logic as to where the conversation is going, and it's as if you don't want to be caught naked emotionally. You don't want to be caught in a state of bewilderment where you're kind of just sitting there and maybe you do love the person in a kind of a funny way, but you're afraid that they'd know that. You know? Like sometimes Sometimes people put on a frown to hide the fact that they want to smile. You know, if you walk up to the reception desk in a hotel and there's a man behind the desk or a woman behind the desk, and if you walk up like smiling, when they catch your eye, or somebody in a burger joint, you know, you're in Supermax or somewhere and you want a burger and chips, and somebody says, next, please, and next, please. And there's a moment where you're looking into their eyes and you want to smile, male or female. You just want to say hello. How are you doing? But you don't. You cover it. You're afraid. You're afraid that the vulnerability of the heart would get you into trouble. So you cover yourself. But if you practice, sometimes sitting in silence with another person and you say nothing. Now, I could do it with that woman. I can do it sometimes almost like from experience, because I know I'm in a zone of being a writer, and that's a disposition that allows you to be silent. And so I'm sitting there in the kitchen with her and I'm silent. And I'm smiling at her. And out of the blue, out of nowhere, she starts to tell me about her father. And I'm receiving her story into my heart. I'm hearing her story like I'm looking at a beautiful hawk hovering in front of me, and I forget everything that's in me. I'm not evaluating it or not. I'm not thinking this is a good story or a bad story. I'm just listening. I'm bearing witness to her story. And that'll fill me up, and when I go home, even a year later, I will be able to access that because I'm close to it. And the funny thing too is that we're afraid of God, you know. I always feel like, why do we endlessly ridicule the concept or the possibility of God? And I think it's because we're afraid. We're afraid that in that silence, you know, you've an open heart. You're wishing generosity. You're wishing everything good to this other person in front of you. And that's okay when you're with a nice old lady who's telling a nice story. But it's trickier when you're with somebody you don't like. Now, if you try it, you know, if you try and have your heart open and wishing good wishes to a person who's sitting in front of you that you don't like, that's challenging, but it's also hugely beneficial, because in some way it changes the proportions of how you see yourself in relation to the world, and you become more distant from your own ego, because you have to, in order to be compassionately loving to the other person, to see the other person as beautiful even though they're irritating you. It actually means that you need to transcend your ego. And that means that the enemy is always your best teacher. You know, your enemy is like an enlightened Buddha who has come to annoy you so that you would become a better person. Because when you're with that person, the person who irritates you, is like, you can step outside your own ego. Funny thing is that stepping outside your own ego is very often stepping inside your own body. The more you step away from your compulsive ego energy, the more you feel aware, more alive in your body. And that's a help. But that's all good when you're dealing with even the lovely old lady or the person that irritates you in work. But even when you're alone, you know, when I'm alone for a few days, I want to turn on the telly. I want to turn on the radio. Because I'm afraid. I'm afraid that, like, I'm afraid that I'm not alone, if you know what I mean. I'm afraid that this kind of presence, call it Buddha presence, call it God's presence, but that presence that's not, you can hear it, it's like a vibration, you can hear it inside you. And it's almost sometimes like being looked at in a way that makes you uneasy. Because it always demands that you let go of the ego. It always demands you let go of your own particular ways of seeing and open your mind to being surprised. Being surprised has to happen as a writer in every sentence maybe, but certainly in every paragraph. Every second or third paragraph, there needs to be, when you're writing, a transition, a kind of a way that something new happens. It comes from left of field. It comes like we didn't expect to go there. So I'm talking about the old lady, and she's talking about, you know, how she was reared and the hard times they had and the way that the clergyman wanted to take away the children, but her father was good and strong, and he said, you know, if you don't mind, I'll keep me children. I love that. As long as I can, and when I can't, I'll let you know. Being civil to the cleric. I could hear her saying it, and I was able to remember it and write it down. But anyway, when I was going home that day, I happened to see a barrel top wagon. And I happened to go in and start talking to people who were living on the side of the road in a barrel top wagon with two children. And it's like, I didn't plan that. I didn't sort of say, oh, I'll write something about this woman and then I'll write about the traveller. No. But when your heart is open, it kind of allows in stuff that's not just within the frame of your intellectual perception. If your intellectual perception is that everybody in the village are sour, everyone is sour, it's likely that the only people you will meet as you go through the village are sour people. But it might just be your perception that filtered their behaviour, you were conditioned to see them in a certain way. Whereas, if, for example, you believe with your heart that every human being you meet is an angel, is angelic, has an angelic light within them, or is the Christ, is actually the Christ, you know, Jesus talked about this, about recognizing the beloved in the poor, in the outcast, in the prisoner, in the sick, right? Recognize the outcast as the beloved. Recognize everybody as the beloved. Beloved of God. So if you have that perception going through the village, that every single person is angelic in that sense, it's likely that you'll fall in love with everybody in the village. We kind of create the universe that we live in. And when we sit alone and we're still and we try and, you know, do guru yoga or say prayers, Christian prayers, to open our heart to God's presence in the environment around us, sometimes it makes us nervous because it's like we feel suddenly we're being looked at. And our negative perceptions might just be challenged. Our negative view of the people on the radio that we don't like, or the people in our family that we can't stand, it might just be challenged. We might start thinking differently. And then, at the end of that little reflection, I went home. Now, I was in this beautiful big house, old 19th century farmhouse in Mullingar at the time, Shandona House. And there I was sitting in the kitchen, and I heard shots. And I thought, there was a little pheasant. There's always a pheasant somewhere in winter. There always is. We had the pheasant called Arthur for years in Leitrim. But even in Mullingar, there was a pheasant. He'd be out there in the winter time. And then in early January, people are allowed to go out. The license says you can go out and shoot. And out to go. And the little vans with dogs and guns. And I was sitting there in the kitchen and I heard the shots. And I thought, that's my little pheasant. Gone. Suppose I could say, in the midst of life we are in debt. That's a fair point to make. You know that the universe is so vast, it's almost like our rational minds can't take it in anyway. So there's no point in trying to reduce the whole world to some set of ideas. These are my ideas. This is what I think. Person, if you're like that, you can never be surprised. You know, somebody says, you know, I know who the good guys are and I know who the bad guys are and I know what I'm doing with my life and I know what my value is and I'm completely aware of, you know, the problems that these people are having and blah de blah. They know everything. And sometimes all that knowing is reducing the mystery of reality to some kind of pattern that makes sense to that individual because that individual has created the pattern. It's where you talk about how we each of us create our own universe. We walk through the village and realize everybody is sour in this village. I know it. And the next person that walks through says, everybody in this village is an angel. Beautiful. I know it. So you create these perceptions and then you tend to get the result that you went out to find. And that's what blocks writing. Because you then start writing, not creatively, but just projecting. You know, your own little patterns of meaning onto the page with words. But it's deeper than that, and it parallels it in the life of faith, because that sense of knowing leads to divisiveness and unhappiness, and it's only when you let go of it that you can hear not just the mysterious wonder of other people's stories, that you can encounter the hovering hawk as a true manifestation of mystery and godness. But it's only then that you can actually experience everything in front of you as the veil which is revealing God's presence to you. The veil, your porridge and your boiled egg, or God on the table in front of you. How could you not be grateful? How could I not be grateful? How could I not be amazed that I am here, that you are here? How could I not be grateful for you? And Guru Yoga, in Buddhist terms, Christian prayers in Christian terms, and all the other beautiful fabric of heart song in other religious traditions, all of them will bring you to the one place. Putting religion as a set of ideas in your head is like a collection of stones in a tin can. But the Tai Chi or the yoga, the expression, the physical embodiment of faith, living the blessed life, makes every single person, of faith and non-faith, like just one single, beautiful, harmonized, conscious embodiment. It's called love. And that's where, if you like, prayer, listening and writing intersect for me. And thank you for being here. Bye-bye.